Advisory, some rain today with temperatures in the mid-50s. It's 6 o'clock.
Republican governor wants to end all vaccine requirements as three Democratic-led states say they can't trust the CDC and will make their own vaccine recommendations. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Survivors of Jeffrey Epstein's abuse rallied at the Capitol yesterday, saying they want closure after decades of suffering. I'm Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Some said if Congress and President Trump don't act, they'll release their own list of names. Also, as Trump attacks the Smithsonian Institution for divisive race-centered ideology, what he calls it, we take a tour of the National Museum of American History to see exactly what's on display. It is Thursday, September 4th. On this day in 1888, George Eastman patented a new easy-to-use kind of camera and trademarked the name Kodak. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Senate Banking Committee holds a hearing today on President Trump's latest nominee for a seat on the Federal Reserve Board. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the hearing comes at a sensitive time for the central bank.
Trump has tapped White House economic advisor Stephen Miron to fill a short-term vacancy on the Fed board. If confirmed, Miron would take the place of Adriana Kugler, who stepped down last month. Trump is also trying to free up another seat on the board by firing Fed Governor Lisa Cook. The president and his allies have accused Cook of making a false statement on a mortgage application. Cook has not been charged, and she's gone to court in an effort to keep her job. If the president is successful in replacing Cook, a majority of Fed governors would be Trump appointees. Trump has repeatedly demanded that the central bank lower interest rates, even though by law the Fed is supposed to be insulated from that kind of political pressure. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is set to testify before the Senate Finance Committee today. He's likely to be asked about some promises he made during his confirmation hearing this year and is broken. For example, Kennedy promised not to change the makeup of a major federal vaccine advisory panel. Instead, Kennedy fired everyone on it. Louisiana's governor says he'll welcome National Guard troops if they're sent to New Orleans. From member station WWNO, Aubrey Juhas reports the reaction from city officials has been mixed.
Crime in New Orleans spiked during the pandemic, but has since fallen. And the city's on pace to log a historic 50-year low in murders this year. City officials noted that decline. They thanked the federal government for its past help, including after January's terrorist attack, but didn't say whether they support the president's current offer. Councilmember Helena Moreno, the frontrunner in the race to be New Orleans' next mayor, said in a statement she will fight to prevent any federal takeover of New Orleans, and said Trump's offer was about scare tactics and politicizing public safety. On X, Louisiana's governor, Jeff Landry, said he welcomes the president's help, not just in the city, but anywhere in the state. For NPR News, I'm Aubrey Juhas in New Orleans.
The Texas Senate has passed a bill calling for one of the country's strictest crackdowns on abortion pills. From member station KUT in Austin, Olivia Aldridge reports.
Texas already has a near total ban on abortion. The newly passed bill aims to curb the practice of out-of-state doctors prescribing abortion pills to Texas residents and sending them through the mail. State Senator Brian Hughes championed the bill in the Texas Senate.
If you manufacture, distribute these drugs, and ship them to Texas for the purpose of killing a little unborn baby, harming a mom, you will be held accountable.
If the governor signs the bill into law, private citizens would be able to sue out-of-state providers of the pills for $100,000 or more. I'm Olivia Aldridge in Austin.
You're listening to NPR News. A bipartisan group of House lawmakers is introducing a bill that would ban lawmakers from trading individual stocks. Supporters say it's intended to address voters' worries that lawmakers could engage in insider stock trading. Watchdog groups have questioned members of both parties about personal stock trades. Some have asked if the lawmakers were influenced by information they got privately while serving in Congress. The conservative news outlet Newsmax has sued industry giant Fox News. Newsmax claims that Fox illegally pressured pay TV platforms to keep the smaller channel out of their offerings. NPR's David Folkenflik reports Fox News rejects the allegations.
Newsmax CEO and founder Chris Ruddy tells NPR that Fox has been very effective in exerting what he calls monopoly power. Newsmax is alleging anti-competitive actions, saying that Fox had secret or implicit deals that raised the cost to pay TV platforms to carry Newsmax, including requirements that those platforms that did so also pay for Fox Business Network or other sister channels. In a statement, Fox says, quote, Newsmax cannot sue their way out of their own competitive failures in the marketplace to chase headlines simply because they can't attract viewers. Yet Fox executives traded concerns as the network bled viewers in the aftermath of the 2020 race, with many fans of President Trump turning instead to Newsmax. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
The government public affairs network C-SPAN has reached an agreement with online streamers YouTube and Hulu. C-SPAN will bring its three channels to the streamers this fall. That includes as part of YouTube's base package lineup for viewers. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org.
Seek help the earliest you can. When you start seeing you're having anger problems, when you start seeing that you're having too many flashbacks, that's the time to seek help, because you're not alone.
This is Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served, a series exploring the challenges Minnesota's veterans face, as well as the opportunities and services available to them.
My name is Harry Hurley. I'm a U.S. Navy veteran and spent 4 years on an aircraft carrier, the USS Independence, during the Vietnam War. One of the biggest problems I see for veterans getting out today is they don't know about all the services available. There's hundreds of organizations just here in Minnesota with educational services, job services, housing, and everything. Now, some of the help at the beginning usually is therapeutic help. But at some point, the veteran has to say, you know, I can go off and start doing some things myself. That's when you look for retreats. That's when you look to volunteer. The sooner you realize the fact that there's a lot of resources, and the sooner you try them, the better. The longer you push it inside you, the harder it is to get it out and fix.
Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served is produced by AMPERS with support from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, providing our veterans with help. Veterans can find that help online at minnesotaveteran.org.
Edition from NPR News, I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And Mae Martinez in Los Angeles, California. States are moving in opposite directions when it comes to vaccines. Florida is moving toward ending vaccine requirements, and three western states are forming an alliance to protect and even expand access to vaccines. We'll have more from Florida and hear from Washington's governor shortly.
But first, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. testifies in the Senate today after a week of upheaval at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Last week, Kennedy pressured the brand new CDC director, Susan Menares, to resign. And when she refused, the White House fired her. Then three top CDC officials resigned in protest.
NPR Selena Simmons-Duffin is here to tell us what to expect at the hearing today. So, Selena, technically, this hearing is not about the turnover of leadership of the CDC.
Right. This is a Senate Finance Committee hearing announced last week to go over the president's 2026 health care agenda.
Okay, so that's the stated topic, but what do you think senators might ask Secretary Kennedy about?
Yeah, I'm expecting it's going to be like a lot of hearings in recent years where there's kind of a split screen depending on the party of the senator doing the questioning. When Democrats are asking the questions, I think they're going to hammer Kennedy about what happened last week at CDC and about vaccine policy. Kennedy has replaced a key vaccine advisory panel with his own hand-picked roster of people who have a history of anti-vaccine activism. They are set to shake up recommendations on a variety of vaccines later this month. Several Democratic lawmakers, a variety of public health groups, and more than 1,000 current and former HHS employees have all called on Kennedy to resign in the last few days. And some Democratic states are now making moves to try and run public health without relying on CDC, given all of the chaos there. Yesterday, California, Washington, and Oregon launched the West Coast Health Alliance to coordinate their own health guidance and vaccine recommendations.
Okay, so that's what you expect to hear from Democrats. What about Republicans?
Republicans are moving in the opposite direction. Florida announced plans to end all vaccine mandates for children and adults yesterday. I think Republican senators will talk a lot about Kennedy's Make America Healthy Again agenda. He's been traveling all around the country with governors who are signing state laws related to some of his food-related priorities, like limiting food dyes and ultra-processed foods. There may be Republicans asking about the drastic cuts in biomedical research funding. I think a lot of people are really going to be wondering what Republican Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana is going to say in this hearing in particular.
Ooh, Bill Cassidy. Why him? Why is that?
Well, Cassidy is a physician. He chairs the health committee, which oversees HHS, and he believes strongly in vaccines. Kennedy won Cassidy's vote by promising he wouldn't change that CDC vaccine advisory panel. Obviously, Kennedy broke that promise. He fired everyone on that committee and replaced them. So I'll be watching to see whether Cassidy is going to call Kennedy out for all of the aggressive changes he's been making when it comes to vaccine policy.
What do you expect to hear from Kennedy?
Well, you know, in interviews over the last week, he seemed kind of unbothered by the upheaval at CDC. He wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend defending his actions. And in the piece, he places the blame for the high COVID-19 deaths in those early years of the pandemic squarely on CDC. Even though I think you could argue that politics and incomplete information about an emerging virus deserve a fair share of the blame. I know what he wants to talk about are his MAHA efforts and what he calls the chronic disease epidemic. So I think he's going to try to keep that the focus as much as possible.
All right, that's NPR Selena Simmons-Duffin. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Officials in Florida say they plan to be the first state to eliminate all vaccine mandates for children and adults. NPR's Greg Allen reports.
Currently, Florida, like all 50 states, requires children to receive multiple vaccinations before entering school. In Florida, some, like the vaccines for polio, diphtheria, measles, and mumps, are actually required by law. At a news conference, Governor Ron DeSantis said he'll ask state lawmakers to pass a bill repealing that requirement. When that will be isn't clear. The next legislative session isn't until the spring. But several other vaccines, including those for chickenpox, hepatitis B, strep, and other infections, are required only by rules issued by the state health department. Florida Surgeon General Joseph Latipo says those rules will be dropped, and those vaccines soon will no longer be required.
You don't want to put whatever vaccines in your body? God bless you. And I hope you make an informed decision. And that's how it should be.
Dr. Latipo has been a controversial Surgeon General since his appointment by DeSantis in 2021. He's been an outspoken opponent of gender-affirming care for minors and the addition of fluoride to municipal water systems. He's a leading critic of the mRNA COVID vaccines. But this proposal goes further, saying the government should not require anyone to receive a vaccine.
Every last one of them, every last one of them is wrong and drips with disdain and slavery.
Public health and child health professionals condemned the move. Dr. Eileen Marty, an infectious disease expert at Florida International University, said this will cause havoc and, quote, is clearly against the empirical evidence of what is safest for individual children. The president of the American Academy of Pediatrics, Dr. Susan Cressley, said she's concerned that the elimination of the vaccine requirement will, quote, put children in Florida public schools at higher risk for getting sick and have ripple effects across their community. Governor DeSantis also announced Wednesday he's forming a new state Make America Healthy Again commission. It will be modeled after the one of the federal commission created by Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. It will be chaired by Florida's lieutenant governor and the governor's wife, Casey DeSantis. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
Now to the West Coast, where state leaders are taking a different approach to vaccine policy.
The governors of California, Oregon, and Washington say they're forming an alliance to counter what they call the politicization of public health.
Joining me now is the Democratic governor of Washington State, Bob Ferguson. So, Governor, why are you and your counterparts in California and Oregon forming this West Coast Health Alliance?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. And we're doing it for a really simple reason, and that is we simply can no longer trust what's coming out of Washington, D.C. and Robert Kennedy Jr. and these endless political attacks on public health and poor information about public health. And so we just decided, the three governors, we decided we just had to take a change in direction, unify together to make sure the public gets the information they need to keep themselves safe and keep our community safe, and so they can make the right kind of decisions for their own health.
What was the tipping point for you and the other governors?
You know, each governor might have a different answer to that. But for me, I think what I would say is just in these last several days and weeks, the firing, for example, of key individuals who run, for example, the CDC, the resignations of key staff, for example, at the CDC, these are career individuals who want nothing more than rely on science and provide good information to the public, that just became increasingly clear to me with those examples and others that our public health information coming from Washington, D.C. was becoming politicized. And people were being appointed to important boards who were vaccine skeptics, for example. And so no longer is science the North Star for decisions coming out of Washington, D.C., but rather there's a different agenda. And I don't think that's the right agenda for the people of my state.
So tell us exactly what the West Coast Health Alliance aims to do. Does the alliance plan to actually expand access to vaccines that are now federally restricted?
Absolutely. So each state, of course, has to pass different laws for their own states in terms of how we effectuate this. But yes, first, we want to band together because that gives us economies of scale. We are three large states, and we share the same vision for public health. So number two, each state will, I anticipate, take different individual actions, but to accomplish the goal you mentioned. So for example, in Washington State, we'll be making sure that pharmacies are required to provide vaccines for certain groups that will be more expansive than the FDA. We think that's very important. So especially we're focused on vaccines, flu shots, measles, COVID, that type of thing. We think the information from Washington, D.C. is just very poor right now, to put it mildly, and that by banding together, we can share better information and also make improvements to our state laws to make sure that our residents have access to the best health care.
So just to be clear, the Food and Drug Administration has now limited approval for the shots to adults 65 and older, or those who are high risk for severe disease. So are you saying that the state of Washington will completely go against that recommendation?
Yes, that's exactly right. And to give you a specific example, in Washington State, you know, we essentially make our decisions based on this, what's called ACIP, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. When they make recommendations, we follow those for how pharmacies and others, insurance companies practice here in Washington State. We'll be disconnecting from that and creating our own guidelines for doctors, for pharmacists, for insurance companies. So yes, we're going to go our own way and we're going to disconnect from what's happening in Washington, D.C. because it is so politicized and it's not good for public health.
Now, you're forming this alliance of some Republican-led states are trying to scale back on vaccine requirements.
Yeah.
Florida, for example, whose Surgeon General announced Wednesday that the state plans to end all vaccine mandates, including for school children. Governor, that policy has not been put in place yet, but do efforts like that undermine what you and the other governors are trying to do on the West Coast?
Well, I guess what I would say is it just makes me sad for kids in Florida, right? That we have this now balkanization in different states in terms of, in this instance, kids getting the right kind of shots that they need to keep themselves safe. I can't do anything about what's going on in Florida. What I can do is do everything I can to make sure that the people of my state, in Washington State, have the right kind of information, they have accurate information, it's scientifically based, and we as a state have policies that guide insurance companies and doctors and pharmacies about that, that we engage in best practices for the best health outcomes for the people of our state. That's what I can control, and that's what I'm focused on.
All right. That's the Democratic governor of the state of Washington, Bob Ferguson. Governor, thanks.
Hey, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
In a statement to NPR, the Department of Health and Human Services said pandemic policies of Democratic-run states eroded the American people's trust in public health agencies. HHS said it will ensure policy is based on rigorous evidence and, quote, gold standard science. We extended invitations to the governor and Surgeon General of Florida. They have not responded to our request. This is NPR News.
Good morning. It's 6:19. Thanks for tuning in. This is the Thursday Morning Show, and it is people-powered radio. Coming up next, we're going to be talking fishing. We'd like to thank Dale's Auto Body for their support. They serve the auto body needs of Grand Rapids and surrounding communities since 1984. Performing auto body and collision repairs, as well as auto glass replacement, dedicated to getting you back on the road after an accident. More information, dalesautobodyinc.com. Weather around the region, it's a chilly morning. You might want a couple of layers. We are seeing current conditions, 41 in Brainerd and Hibbing, Bemidji at 42, Park Rapids 43, so is Grand Rapids, and it's looking like Floodwood at 40 right now, Ely reporting 39 and 37 in Baudette. There is a good chance for some showers today with increasing clouds, highs 50 to 57, west winds 5 to 15. Showers likely tonight with cloudy skies and temperatures in the low 40s. Northwest winds gusting up to 25. Cloudy for tomorrow with highs in the mid to upper 50s. Breezy northwest winds and evening temperatures in the low 40s. And for Saturday, Grand Rapids Riverfest Day, expecting partly sunny skies with highs in the upper 50s to low 60s. Love to hear from you this morning, the temperature where you are. Have you had any frost? Have any questions for Jeff coming up next as we talk fishing? Text us 218-326-1234.
Gone fishing. Babble, 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 babble. There's a sign up on your door.
Pops, don't blab it around, will you?
Gone fishing.
Keep it shady. I got me a big one staked out.
You ain't working anymore.
I don't have to work. I got me a piece of Gary.
Cows need milking in the barn.
I have the twins on that detail. They each take a side.
But you just don't give a darn.
Give them 4 bits of cow and hand lotion.
You just never seem to learn.
Man, you taught me.
You ain't got no ambition.
You're convincing.
Gone fishing. Got your hound dog by your side.
That's old Cindy Lou going with me.
Gone fishing. Fleas are biting at his hide.
Get away from me, boy, you bother me. Folks won't find us now because Mr. Satch and Mr. Cross, we gone fishing. Instead of just a wishing,
bop-a, baby, bop-a, bop-a, bop-a.
Oh, yeah.
It is Thursday morning, and that means it's time to talk fishing with Jeff Sundin, our early bird fishing guide. Morning, Jeff. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. You're welcome.
So last week we started talking about how the temperatures are dropping in the lakes, and we've had some cooler temperatures this week. What are you feeling, seeing, and what does that mean for fishing?
Well, it's a mixed, the results aren't equal every place. There's a few lakes that are trying to be kind of like right in the middle of the fall pattern, and there's a few lakes that are trying to hang on tight to the old summer ways of doing things. And then there's a handful of them that I can't quite figure out what they're doing exactly. But everything, it's definite that there's a transition going on. So we're going to have to go like lake by lake and sort of feel our way through them here for the next few days or so. The cold front, this little bit of thunderstorm and cooler temperatures, this is going to drag things down pretty quickly. Now, we were talking just a week or two ago about water temperatures that were in the mid-70s. By Sunday, the water temperature on Winnie, for example, was down to 70. I was fishing some smaller lakes earlier this week and seeing water temperatures in the 60s, 67, 68. Typically, what happens on this first little go-around of cold weather that we get, the lakes sort of drive down really quick until they reach about 65 or 66 usually, and then they hit a spot where they don't really want to go lower than that for a little while. So I'm kind of anticipating that we'll get stuck in that neighborhood over the next few days, and I guess the worst part about it, if you want to say worst, is that the summertime kind of being able to troll around with a spinner and locate fish, and then once you know where they're at, kind of keep catching them. that's given away a little bit right now. The days of being able to go out and get 7 or 8 species by trolling spinners is kind of winding down. You can maybe still find a few. I noticed the last couple of days now, we've been able to find a few panfish by trolling. But once I find them, if I really want to catch them, I've got to stop and really fish straight up and down almost vertically. And depending on the lake, that could be right in the weeds, or on a couple of lakes, it could be out in the open water. Now we encountered one where the crappies and sunfish had moved out of the weed beds within about 2 or 3 days of the first little cool snap that we got, and they were staged out over kind of open mid-lake flats. The water depth was about 20 feet, 22, 24, depending on where we were fishing. But here's the interesting part. Even though the water was 24 feet, the crappies were about 7 or 8 feet below the surface of the water. So if you were trying to fish anywhere close to the bottom, you were not going to catch anything. You had to stay up kind of towards the surface. So either a slip bobber with a jig and a live minnow, or casting small plastic tails that kind of vibrate and pulsate as you reel them back through that upper layer of the water would work, would do the job. Fishing vertically would work as long as you were able to stay on top of the fish, but when they spread out horizontally like that, it can be sort of tricky to be where the fish are all the time. Sometimes you have to kind of keep moving. Now, this time of year, I know that I just said trolling presentations are kind of losing their grip, but whatever the reason for it is, the fish differentiate. If I say trolling spinners, or little beetle spins, or things, kind of flashy baits, yes, those fish do sort of give up on that stuff. But now, for some reason, small crankbaits like a shad wrap or any number of the other small minnow-type baits, for some reason, the fish will respond to those still throughout this period. So if you were enjoying catching fish by trolling with spinners and that gives up on you, swap over and try some small crankbaits, especially when you encounter these suspended fish, because that gives you a little more control of the depth. Most crankbaits are designed to run best at a certain depth, and you can pick the ones. If you're seeing fish in 10 feet of water, you can find baits that'll run at that depth, and so on and so forth. And that's not a bad way if you want to keep on the move, especially when you're in search mode for some of the panfish, crappie, sunfish, and even to a certain extent, walleyes.
Okay, now, am I mistaken? Did I dream this? I think I saw a picture of you with a big northern, didn't I?
I love catching those things. Yep. Now, it's been interesting. Over the past few years, I've been sort of fine-tuning some. I got a couple of ideas about pike. There's a little interchange going on between me and a couple of DNR fisheries biologists now. So this is going to wind up being a full scale. We're going to get really serious about this over the next few weeks. But right now, in a nutshell, our region, the north central zone, which covers about 2/3 of the state, so there's lots of people that are affected by this. The northern pike regulation that we've got in place is you're allowed 10 fish, but they have to mostly be under 22 inches. You could have 2 fish above 26 if you're lucky enough to be able to catch those. The trouble is the 22-inch, the bottom end, the lower threshold, isn't really very attractive. People don't get too interested in harvesting the pike until they wind up being maybe 21 to 23, someplace in that range. They start to take on just a little bit more girth, and they're a little more attractive fish. As those fish, there are lakes where the fish do make it through that slot and start to show up over 26. The trouble with that is that each one of those fish that achieves 26.1 inches, folks harvest them as soon as they catch them. So it's getting pretty rare to catch like two or three 26 or 27 inch fish in the same day. I'm not saying that it doesn't happen, but if you take this much territory and put it under that one big blanket regulation, you could see where certain lakes it gets tricky to ever really catch anything that interests people. So I've been doing a little workaround on this and seeking out the lakes that have got special northern pike regulations that vary from the north central zone regulation. And by doing that, a lot, there's a good number of lakes in our region that they've gone to a special protected slot size of 24 to 36 inches. Now, that's a big, wide swath of fish that are protected. But what that does is it keeps those larger fish in the system, which, if I understand correctly, and we'll write more about this in the future, but the original intent of protecting some larger northern pike is that the pike themselves can control the population of small fish. Angling pressure alone will never be able to catch and keep enough of those small northern pike to ever improve the size structure, especially when the public doesn't perceive those fish as being harvestable fish. They don't really want them that small. So we need the larger fish in the system. These special regulations allow you to have three fish rather than 10 fish. And that's fine. People aren't that greedy. Three northern pike, especially if they're kind of plump and fat ones, is a good amount of fish. We get more than we need. I know Susan and I, when we want one, we got special recipes for special sizes of pike. If we get one 27-inch northern, for example, we're good to go for two or maybe even three meals out of that using the coconut pike recipe. And the smaller fish, we use those for blackening. And a lot of times, if I'm cooking a shore dinner or something for people, a 21 or even a 20-inch northern pike, cut in half and just fry that up the way you would fry any other fish, really are delicious fish, especially when they're straight out of the lake and fresh. So that all kind of works out to be fine. Three fish, no big problem. But we catch some nice fish along the way, like the picture that you're talking about. That one was 36 inches right on the nose. And without this special regulation, that fish probably wouldn't have even been in that lake because somebody would have harvested by now. So these special regulation lakes, if you're interested in catching larger pike and you don't have to have a freezer full of them, you can get a couple. It gives you a couple inches at the bottom end instead of a 22-inch northern limit. Now you can go up to 24, so when you reach that 23-inch size, those fish look pretty nice. A couple of those works out to be just a nice catch. All around, I think it's a better... Now, there's the regulation works in some lakes, and admittedly, there's a ton of lakes in our area. There's so much spawning habitat. It just keeps producing more and more fish. The competition for food and the lack of space for those fish to grow, a special regulation like the one I'm talking about probably still won't work on a lot of lakes. But the ones that it will work on, I think the more expansion of that, the better. And I'm sort of ashamed of this because I was one of the people that contributed to the decline in the northern pike size structure in our area, because we just really didn't understand, you know, what it meant back in the quote unquote, you know, my formative years or the good old days, whatever you want to call it. 30 plus years ago, it was common to be able to catch a good amount of northerns in the 5 to, let's say, 10 pound neighborhood. In fact, early in my career, we had I had lots of people that liked to fish for northerns, and we had what was called the 50-pound club. If I had two people fishing with me, the goal was to come back to the dock with 50 pounds of northerns for those two people. Well, that at the time, that seemed like a perfectly reasonable thing to do because they were plentiful and there wasn't that much interest in harvesting pike and so on and so forth. But anyway, to get back to that, I think we've got to get pretty serious about protecting the larger ones. And so I'm trying to make up for my past mistakes and encourage folks, catch a few of those smaller ones, put those in the frying pan or whatever. If you're going to keep a harvestable large fish, one should do the job. You know, that's more than enough. And by doing it that way, we'll have a little bit better supply going into the future. So, and the hippie chick will really appreciate it because now that I've done this week, she's hot to trot, and she wants me to take her out and find her one of those large pike too. So,
okay,
that I need all the help I can get, don't I?
Yeah. Yep. There's I'm checking out your fishing report at jeffsundin.com. There's photos and the explanation here of all the northern regulations and everything too. So
yeah, and there's going to be some more, like I said. That in the meantime, if you want to find those, page 45 of the DNR regulation book lists every lake in the state that has any form of a special regulation. So it'll take a little bit of reading down the list, but you can go to some of your favorite lakes and see which ones have got a special regulation on the northern pike and give that a try. You know, go to one of these 24 to 36 inch lakes and see what did you think about it. It's really not that much harder to catch those fish. The same presentations and techniques work just as well. You just have to have the fish in the lake before it works.
All right. Well, we talked about the cooler temperatures in the lakes that you're finding, but are some fish still in the places they hang out in the summertime too?
Yeah, there are. Some of the crappies have been still holding tight in the weeds, and up until a few days ago, they were insisting on making us wait until the evening before they would start to bite. So just finding them wasn't really good enough. We had to kind of get them, figure them out, and then when the sun started to go down, they would begin to move a little bit. Now, with this, even this last couple of days of really cold weather, that's liable to change, and we'll probably have some more to talk about when it comes to that next week. Walleye fishing, the fish are beginning to move out a little bit. I see we've got some really good breezy days predicted now between here and the end of the weekend. I'm thinking that combined with the full moon that happens on Sunday, I think it is, maybe Monday the 7th, whichever day that is, I'm thinking that we could be looking at a fairly strong walleye weekend coming up here. We'll see really how it plays out to be sure, but typically what happens this time of year, as the water temperature goes down, we hit this full moon. A lot of years it happens towards the tail end of August, so it's actually a little later than average right now. But that full moon tends to ramp up the walleye activity, pike too, as far as that's concerned. And we get a couple of 3 days of really good fishing, followed by sort of a slow taper down. As long as the wind and the weather stay favorable, it'll kind of continue. But then we'll get another period. It'll warm back up. The sun will come out. Things are going to get calm again, and it'll slow down. We'll have a little lull in the action again. Then the next cool snap, the next time the wind picks back up, that'll be the beginning of the fall bite, and it will be, we'll have nothing but good news probably for about 3 or 4 weeks after that.
Sounds good. Well, let's leave them with a tease here. Is there really a new work group with the Minnesota DNR?
Have you ever heard of WinFig?
No, I have not.
Okay, well, that's the Winnie Fisherman Input Group, or the Winnie Fishing Input Group. So this one is designed especially for Lake Winnebogoche. And, of course, I, being a glutton for punishment, applied and wound up getting on to that. So that gives me three work groups now that I'll be on. And the meetings will start up here in October sometime. It's a kind of a well-rounded operation. They've got a couple resorts on there, some local anglers that just like Winnie, a couple of fishing guys. Now, interestingly, I'm not on this one as a guide. I guess I've done enough outdoor writing and promotional things and that. So now I have qualified myself to be on this group as a member of the media. So it'll be kind of a, I guess, six one way, half dozen the other, sort of a different way of looking at things, but sort of the same way too. So we'll have plenty to report on that. And I just put on the Fish Wrapper website, I just put some news releases. The DNR is recruiting people for a Cabotogama fishery input group, and they're also recruiting people for the catfish advisory group and some of the wildlife groups too. So folks that like to stand up and put their two cents worth in, there's going to be lots of opportunity to do that coming up here real shortly.
Check it out at jeffsundin.com. Have a great weekend. We'll check in next Thursday.
Thanks. You too. We'll see ya.
Bye-bye. Let us know. Are you been out on the lakes? Are you fishing? You're looking forward to fall fishing? You can text us at 218-326-1234. Coming up, we've got national native news, and we are learning this morning about a case that has the potential to overturn decades of hard-fought legal battles to protect traditional fishing rights in rural Alaska. Make sure you stay tuned for that story. And then we'll be bringing you more from Morning Edition. We're going to be hearing about a literary small town in Texas and live music from Malachi Coons with the set list. Good chance of showers today. Increasing clouds with highs 50 to 57. West winds 5 to 15. Showers are likely tonight. Cloudy with temperatures in the low 40s. Northwest winds gusting up to 25 miles an hour.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The case had the potential to overturn decades of hard-fought legal battles to protect traditional fishing rights in rural Alaska. But in the end, the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals sided with the federal government in its lawsuit against the state to protect those rights. As KMBA's Rhonda McBride tells us, the win is a major victory for tribes.
This summer, for the first time in a long time, smokehouses along the Kuskokwim River were filled with bright red salmon.
We have no other choice but to prepare for hard winters, and it has been very difficult for us to meet our annual subsistence needs for the last 10 years.
Mike Williams serves on the Kuskokwim River Intertribal Fish Commission, which joined the federal lawsuit against the state.
As a fisherman in these hard times, I was very pleased on the Ninth Circuit decision.
The federal appeals court affirmed ANILCA, the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, a law Congress passed in 1980 that gives rural residents who are mostly Alaska Native top priority to harvest the salmon. The court says the state broke that law in 2021 when it ignored restrictions that federal managers imposed to save a struggling salmon run, as well as subsistence protections an Athabascan elder named Katie John had won in numerous court battles. The crux of the problem remains the state's constitution, which doesn't allow for a rural priority. Alaska's Attorney General Treg Taylor says he's disappointed in the decision, but not surprised. In a statement, he said the case would need to be decided at the highest level, yet stopped short of saying whether the state plans to appeal this case to the U.S. Supreme Court. And that has Joe Nelson, co-chair of the Alaska Federation of Natives, worried there could be more litigation ahead.
This is going to be just another chapter in the story that's going to continue.
Although this case involved one river, Nelson says there is so much at stake for all Alaska Natives. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
A youth curfew aimed at reducing violent crime in the Gila River Indian community in Arizona has been in place since late February. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, the curfew will now be in effect through the end of the year.
It marks the fourth time the curfew has been extended. In this latest executive order, Governor Stephen Roe Lewis wrote that the tribes south of Phoenix saw a decline in crime between June and August, but concerns over threats to public safety still remain, with Lewis adding that emergency action gives us stronger, more flexible tools to prevent violence and disorder before it starts. Leaders are even considering banishment as a solution. The tribe is surveying its membership about a draft ordinance to banish its own members who are convicted of committing violent crimes on the nearly 600-square-mile reservation. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
The Spirit Lake Nation, the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa Indians, and Native voters are formally asking the U.S. Supreme Court to review their case involving Native voting rights in North Dakota in the court's upcoming term. They filed a petition Tuesday. According to attorneys, the plaintiffs have been fighting for fair representation for Native voters since 2022. Public statements and expert testimony in the Line 5 reroute begin Wednesday in Madison, Wisconsin, and Bridge Energy plans to build a new 41-mile segment of its pipeline. Tribal and environmental groups are among those in opposition raising environmental concerns, while supporters are pointing to jobs and an economic boost. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation with funding in part by listener members as well as the Annenberg Foundation and the Ford Foundation. Getting ready for Saturday's Grand Rapids Riverfest. There are still tickets available. You can go to grandrapidsriverfest.com. We're so excited. Our headliner from Australia, Courtney Barnett. And then we've got Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, as well as Alan Sparhawk. Anywhere from Nashville to Australia to Duluth to Canada. These voices are going to come together on the banks of the Mississippi River. It's going to be a great day to hang out with friends, a little chilly at night. We'll see that full moon. We hope that you will be there, GrandRapidsRiverFest.com. That is the place to get the tickets. Last night I was digging in a little bit to Margot Price's brand new album that just came out. Here is a song from her that she did with Tyler Childers. It's called Love Me Like You Used to Do. This is from Margot Price's Hard-Headed Woman, her fifth studio album.
Let's go down to the bar like we did in the old days. We'll sit down, buy us a beer. I'll come over all coy like they do in the movies. What's someone like you doing here? We'll use all our own lines. Don't I know you from somewhere? We'll pretend we're with somebody new. Call us a taxi, pull me into the backseat, and love me like you used to do. Oh, love me like you used to do.
Well, life ain't always roses. Let's forget all our woes and go out and pick up some wine. We'll come back to the house when we're all out of money. We'll have us a real swinging time. We work all the week. Let's call out tomorrow and do what it takes to get through. Maybe light me some candles, chase each other around, and love me like you used to do.
We've got time.
That is new music, Love Me Like You Used to Do, featuring Tyler Childers. It's from Margot Price, coming to Grand Rapids Riverfest this Saturday. Find out more about her new album, Hard-Headed Woman, at KAXE.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Larry McMurtry was the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Lonesome Dove. He also won an Oscar for co-writing the screenplay for Brokeback Mountain. And he founded a bookstore in his hometown, Archer City, Texas. The store was eventually acquired by HGTV's Chip and Joanna Gaines and then sold and recently transformed into a literary center. The hope is it can jumpstart a tourism economy in Archer City, center on its favorite son. John Burnett reports.
The lunch crowd at Mern's Cafe in Archer City.
You're very welcome, sweetie. Have a good day.
An evangelist is preaching on the TV in the corner. Chicken fried steak is the daily special on the menu. Proprietor Mern Wages remembers her famous customer, Larry McMurtry, in the years before he died in 2021.
I miss him being here. He sit right there at that booth. And he ordered a cheeseburger cut in half and a piece of cherry pie.
McMurtry was a celebrated novelist, screenwriter, and essayist of the Old West in contemporary Texas. Films adapted from his books, like Horsemen Pass By, The Last Picture Show, and Terms of Endearment, won 13 Oscars. The TV series Lonesome Dove won 7 Emmys. McMurtry was also a voracious book collector. His sprawling collection in this tiny town 2 hours northwest of Dallas became an international attraction. To Mern's delight, the bookstore reopened last spring, but only on weekends.
I hope it starts bringing a lot of tourists back to our little town. It was neat because people come from overseas, people came from all over the world to go to Larry's bookstore.
2 blocks down Center Street from Mern's Cafe sits the Larry McMurtry Literary Center, next to the Methodist Church and across the street from the Baptists. It is housed inside of his famous bookstore, Booked Up.
We're here inside Booked Up. This was a place that Larry, it was the center of his literary universe.
George Getchow, award-winning former journalist, educator, and now executive director of the Literary Center, stands reverently next to the floor-to-ceiling bookshelves.
He got married inside here. He directed in his will that his ashes be kept here forever and ever. He wrote in the morning, spent all of his time the rest of the day pricing books, curating books, writing comments in books, and cherishing these books. I've never known anyone who loved books as much as Larry McMurtry.
Time was McMurtry had 4 locations in town crammed with more than 400,000 books. After he died, along came Chip and Joanna Gaines of the Fixer Upper Magnolia Network. They bought his remaining collection so they could cherry pick books to stock the library in their new upscale hotel in Waco. Meanwhile, Getchow had been looking for a permanent home for his Archer City Writers Workshop. Last year, the Gaineses sold Booked Up to the Getchow Group, and it became the Larry McMurtry Literary Center.
The goal of the Literary Center is to preserve and perpetuate this book collection. It's a remarkable, immense book collection. This is really is a temple. It's a sacred place. We all feel that way.
It's also falling apart, like the ramshackle houses of the cowboys who populate McMurtry's books. Kathy Floyd, managing director of the center, says they need heating and air conditioning, new plumbing, and a new roof.
Water comes in at the ground level and it seeps in and leaves puddles. The books that are on the bottom shelves have been damaged because it soaks up.
And we lost a number of books that were against that wall. Really very precious books that we put there because we had no other place to put them.
In much of his writing, McMurtry was rough on Archer City. Just watch The Last Picture Show. He portrayed the suffocating bleakness of small town life and self-destructive cowboys and oil field hands who burned out early. But then McMurtry came home. His ambitions were to turn his one-stoplight hometown into one of the world's great book centers. Jenny Schrader is volunteer coordinator at the Writers' Center and an Archer City native. She says McMurtry himself cowboyed on the family ranch when he was growing up.
For Archer City itself, it means a lot that he was part of our town. He came from this ranching tradition that is still alive, very much alive today. And I think it shows the value in that tradition, and it also shows the value in an alternate route.
McMurtry took that alternate route. Books revealed a kaleidoscopic world beyond the ranch and celebrated the life of the mind. He would write them and collect them and treasure them his entire life. Today, the Larry McMurtry Literary Center aspires to keep his passion for books alive and promote a different kind of travel, literary tourism. For NPR News, I'm John Burnett in Archer City, Texas.
This is The Set List on KAXC, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. Grand Rapids Riverfest is here, this Saturday, September 6th, at the Public Library Amphitheater, close to the banks of the Mississippi River. Here's info on all four artists on the lineup. This year's headliner is Courtney Barnett, an Australian indie rocker acclaimed for her witty observations on the everyday and mundane, all in her trademark deadpan delivery. Besides her songwriting, Barnett is a modern guitar hero whose playing ranges from delicate to total shredding and makes her live show can't miss. Just before Courtney is the outlaw country maverick Margot Price, fresh off the release of Hard-Headed Woman, her fantastic new fifth album. Since her 2016 debut, Price has been a breath of fresh air in the country music world. Her current band features flat-picking prodigy and vocalist Logan Ledger, and they easily take listeners to the funky, rocking, and psychedelic corners of country music. Playing second this year is rising Canadian roots musician Jeremy Albino, my pick for this year's biggest surprise. If Albino is new to you, you're in for a retro-rocking and magnetic stage performer who brings to mind the early days of rock and roll music. This year's opener is Minnesota's own Alan Sparhawk, a northern Minnesota institution since the mid-90s with acclaimed indie rock band Low. His most recent project was a collaboration with fellow Duluth musicians Trampled by Turtles, a cathartic album that navigated his grief after the death of life and musical partner Mimi Parker. Now his live band includes his son Cyrus on bass, and Dave from Trampled by Turtles will be joining him this Saturday. Gates open at 2 p.m. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Coming up on the Thursday morning show on People Powered KAXC, we bring you local news with the Up North Report. I'm Heidi Holton with Kari Headland. We'd like to thank Grand Rapids State Bank for their support, committed to serving the Grand Rapids area for over 110 years. More at grsb.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. We'd also like to thank the Pines Restaurant in downtown Grand Rapids. Hosting a late night patio party until 1 a.m. immediately following Riverfest with Asian street food, handcrafted cocktails, and more. Restaurant info available at thepinesmn.com. We do have a good chance of showers for today with increasing clouds. Highs 50 to 57 degrees, west winds 5 to 15. Showers are likely for tonight with cloudy skies, temperatures in the low 40s. Mostly cloudy tomorrow, highs in the mid to upper 50s. But by Saturday, Riverfest Day, partly sunny, highs in the upper 50s to low 60s. Our question of the week, we are collecting stories. We want to know with Grand Rapids Riverfest, if you've been to it before, what has it been like? Do you have a story to share with us? You can text 218-326-1234 or tell us about concerts that you have gone to because of the music you heard on KAXC, the influence of the great music programming. We heard from someone earlier this week saying that they saw Charlie Crockett and Leon Bridges in Milwaukee last week with amazing performances, and it was a thank you to KAXC for introducing this person to the artists and consistently playing lesser-known talent on KAXC. So many whose talent should be widely recognized receive little play on commercial radio. Coming up a little bit after 8 o'clock, we're learning about a celebration of Old Central School in Grand Rapids, celebrating 130th birthday, and then before 9 o'clock, we hear from